Gather terani marie, orang inu ye tui honei, o papu tuanu kue takatonei, o te taiae afinei ia tātou, tihei mauri ora. This is The Green Desk on 95BFM.
Today on The Green Desk, we are double dipping. Jack Marshall has been working his tail off in the newsroom, as always, just being a good bloke and getting lots of good stories. So the first piece we're going to do is with David Parker. It's looking at Our Land Report 2018. So we're looking at the report released by the government, and that's the name of it, Our Land 2018. Jack spoke with Minister for the Environment, David Parker, about what this report's implications may be. First up, we got the Minister's take on what struck him about the report.
Well, the issue that most surprised me, actually, was how widespread the compaction of soils has become. They highlight that the high stocking rates, particularly associated with some dairy practices, are compacting soils so that the spaces that used to be between particles of soil which could have air or store water have been squeezed out, a bit like a sponge being squeezed, so the land is less able to absorb water and nutrients, which means that it's, you know, dries out quicker. The nutrients that are on the surface are more likely to flow across the land and get into waterways than be stored in the root zone for plants. So I thought that was a bit of a wake-up call.
And that's largely to do with intensification, isn't it?
That's right. It's intensification of land use, more weight of animals upon the land, and sometimes the pugging that results, particularly in wet weather.
And something I actually really found interesting was our total area taken up by agriculture has actually dropped, where intensification has like largely increased. And, you know, as you say, this is kind of contributing to the soil erosion and impact on water quality. So is a large kind of answer to this is just less intensification. Do we have too many cows?
Well, we think that you should have to get a resource consent to have a significantly increased intensity of ruminant agriculture. That was proposed in a national policy statement that was completed by the former Chief Planning Judge Shepherd. And it came out of the RMA system just after the last Labor government left office and National were appointed, but they spiked it and didn't proceed with it and came up with their version instead. And of course, in the meantime, there were, you know, after that date, there were about a million extra cows. Cow numbers are now tailing off, but we should still be concerned that in some parts of the country we don't have adequate controls on increasing intensity of land use.
Something I found also interesting was that we haven't even kind of reached a point where we've stopped like the decline of a lot of our ecosystems and things. We're still on the downhill. So I was wondering, how do we actually bring a halt to this kind of decline in our ecosystem? Because we're kind of stuck in these feedback loops, which seem to be taking us further down than even, progressing. How do we kind of stop this on a nationwide kind of scale?
Well, we need more national direction under the RMA. Two cases, or three cases in point, actually. One are we're going to revisit the National Policy Statement on Freshwater Quality to look at this issue as to whether you should require a resource consent everywhere if you're going to substantially increase land use intensity, for example, by converting to a dairy farm or putting in a beef feedlot, those sorts of things. Mm. Secondly, it's worrisome that even though we've long ago lost about 90% of our wetlands, and that includes in both estuarine areas and in the mid-country, we're still losing some of the residue. Although the rate of loss is not what it used to be, in my view, we also need a national policy statement to protect wetlands and estuarine areas. There is some good news on that front. Because there's more awareness of this now, there are some wetlands that are being restored in different parts of the country, but we need to do better on that front. And the third area where we need more national direction is in respect of protecting our elite soils, those soils that are so versatile that they can be used for the production of vegetables or horticulture, you know, growing trees and things. And the report makes it clear that we're losing those to urbanisation around our cities, in part because they're easy to build on because they're generally flat. They're often old swamps, wetlands that have been reclaimed previously, or floodplains. So they're easy to build on, which is why people do. But it's not just that intense urbanisation, it's lifestyle blocks on the edges of cities which cut them up into reasonably big hunks but nonetheless make it less possible for them to be utilised for their most important purpose, which is growing food.
And then another couple of points was I was really interested about the impact that climate change is going to have on like things like the water table. So mentioned in the report was the fact that our groundwater is actually being at risk of being contaminated by rising sea levels. I was wondering, are coastal areas, especially local government, are they aware of the risks in building and planning?
They are. They sometimes say that they want more guidance from central government. And I'll give you an example of why that's sometimes necessary. If you own a piece of rural land near the coast, you can sometimes make millions of dollars by converting it into some highly desirable subdivision near the coast. Now, it's quite hard for the council to beat that on their own, even though from a countrywide perspective, whilst the individual person doing the subdivision might be doing well out of it, it seems silly to put extra built infrastructure at risk to rising sea levels. So there is guidance that has gone out, it's actually just been updated this year actually, gone out to regional councils about likely sea level rise that should be planned for in the long term. But some councils say even that's not enough and that there need to be stricter rules so that they don't have to have these fights locally. And they can just rely upon central government having made the decisions at a higher level.
Yeah, because I have heard of quite a few cases of landowners, especially on the coastal areas, which now boast, you know, multi-million dollar properties. They're kind of fighting back against this awareness that their properties are at risk of rising sea levels.
Yeah, well, you know, in the end, insurance companies are showing an interest in this too, and they're making it clear that if governments don't, local government or central government don't plan this appropriately, people are going to find some of these properties increasingly expensive or even hard to insure. So, I think as a country, we're probably doing better than most countries on that front because we've been more aware of climate change than a lot of other countries, but nonetheless, our performance there isn't perfect. In respect of your issues about aquifer levels, we've got to be putting aside the intrusions of seawater, which of course become a lot higher risk as sea levels rise. We've also got to be careful that we don't allow irrigation to draw down or mine down our levels of water in our aquifers for two reasons. One, you shouldn't be doing that anyway, and I'll come back to that, but also because the lower they are, the more easy it is for salt water to intrude into them because there's gravity winds. So, but the first reason that we shouldn't be mining them down is that, you know, take South Canterbury. Although they had a very, very wet winter last winter, the wettest winter since the 1970s. And so last summer, the lowland rivers in Canterbury ran reasonably freely because there was so much water sitting in the aquifer. The year before, though, after they'd had a few dry years in a row, with the level of irrigation pressure, the aquifer levels had been drawn down so that the lowland rivers weren't flowing as they used to. So that was a very controversial in South Canterbury, where a lot of people were annoyed that their rivers weren't running in summer because they generally recharge from the aquifer, which was no longer coming to the surface as high up the river.
Iridangi Paul, Radio Bosom.
The Wire. That was Jack Marshall speaking to Minister of the Environment, David Parker. The time is now 12:33, and we're going back-to-back with Jack today. He has got two stories on the Green Desk today. The Green Desk was full in the newsroom. The second chat Jack has today is with Sahib Rafiq, a researcher from Australia who is looking into how the rise of electric cars may impact the power grid. Interesting story. To start off, we asked Sahib to look into the issue.
What we did was we've got the vehicle trips data of 56 local government areas of New South Wales, and we found that there are more than 11 million vehicle trips on an average weekday. And out of those 11 million vehicle trips, 18% of the vehicle trips, that is about 2 million vehicle trips, they're the commute trips. And when we say commute, it's from home to work and work to home. That is from A to B and B to A again.
That's your kind of everyday.
Oh, exactly, yes. And interestingly, the weekday commute vehicle trips was less than 35 kilometers per trip. This shows that if all those vehicle trips were converted to electric vehicles, then probably normally affordable electric vehicles could easily manage those trips. And even interestingly, there was a study conducted in U.S. So where they have studied the commutes across the U.S. and estimated approximately the same results. So this is somehow consistent throughout the big cities. And we do have some good news as well. So electric vehicles can serve as energy storages.
So like more or less the cars can just act as...
Manage themselves, yes.
Yeah, like large batteries just rolling around.
Exactly, yes. So there definitely are the large batteries rolling around. Electric vehicles will not certainly have that massive impact as it seems to have on the electric grids.
Will there really be any major challenges on the grid, do you think? Like, will there be kind of more localized issues there, or is it more or less overall pretty good?
It would certainly... So, as I said, so if it is managed appropriately, the charge scheduling, then probably the grids won't be facing any major impacts. But yes, if the charge scheduling is not managed, and if all the vehicles are allowed to charge whenever they want, then probably you'll be having different peaks at different times. And those unexpected times, then probably this would be imbalances, load imbalances on the grid side, and they'll be facing the music.
Yeah. So more or less, we just need to make sure that cars are being charged evenly, not all are kind of, you know, at night,
yes,
or all at the same time.
Exactly. Not all at the same time, yeah.
Yeah. So what actually got you into looking into electric cars? What kind of piqued your interest?
Okay, so the great thing was my research interest, or my area of research, was more into integrating the distributed energy resources into the grid in order to minimize the impact. So we were looking at the renewable energy sources like the photovoltaics, like the solar panels and the PVs. Then we see the upcoming trend of electric cars. We saw that the sales of electric cars has increased by 70% in 2015 compared to 2014 globally. So, and there is a global trend of electric cars. So when electric car is coming, it's coming with the challenges and it's coming with the opportunities. So we thought of digging into that further.
Yeah. And so was there anything in your research that kind of really surprised you when you kind of looked into the research?
Probably this was one of the things which was surprising, that energy demand could easily be met by the energy available with electric vehicles. So it's not a threat at all if the energy is managed evenly. Like, if you consider those electric vehicles as energy resources, and if you'll be able to manage them, then probably it's not a threat at all.
What did you think was gonna happen?
Yes. So initially, we had a thought that if these electric vehicles would only be considered as the energy, what do you call them? Energy loads, energy consumers only, then this would certainly have some problems if they're not managed appropriately. But yes, again, there comes a blessing in disguise when the energy is available with them and you can also utilize that energy.
Yeah. And so have you actually spent any time in some electric cars yet?
Driving them?
Yeah.
Yes, we do have one in the university for the research purpose. That's Mitsubishi iMiEV.
So, and how does it feel? Because I know there's like kind of there's the research side, and then there's actually like being in the electric car.
That really is soundless and you exactly don't know that when you're sitting in the car and the car is on, you exactly don't know if it is actually on. So you can't feel anything in terms of engine sound. So many times when you drive the normal conventional vehicles and when you come into electric cars, then probably there is a certain difference in terms of sound when you don't know if the car is actually on. And the second thing would be the power. Power is comparatively lower than the conventional vehicles. So when you are on the steep slopes and you are climbing up, then probably you'll have a feel.
So you might, if you want to have like the speed, you might have to go for like a Tesla.
Oh, exactly. Go for Tesla. Man, Teslas have solved the problem. They've solved the range anxiety issues. They've probably done everything. They're providing long ranges as 1,000 kilometers. I think for the Roadster they have 1,000 kilometers range, and for the normal Model S and Model X they have they're more than 500 kilometers. That's too much for a car when you only need 35 kilometers per trip.
That was the Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Ora.
Big thanks to Jack.